The hunt for the Higgs boson particle, the God particle, is well ahead of schedule, say researchers at the Large Hadron Collider, CERN. Earlier this year, they said they would either discover the Higgs or confirm it does not exist by the end of 2012. Now, the machine they say is working so well, the search could be completed much sooner. The Higgs boson is the particle that, in physics, the standard model allows other particles to have mass. So we'll continue to follow up on that story. In a moment, Dr. John Brandenburg joins us. He's a plasma physicist, and we're going to be talking about Beyond Einstein's Unified Field. Stand by on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Dr. John Brandenburg, PhD, plasma physicist, did his graduate work in California at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab in Controlled Plasmas for Fusion Power. He's worked in defense, energy, space research. He was also part of the Clementine mission to the moon, which discovered water at the moon's poles. And his focus, of course, his scientific career, his push, has been to complete the great effort of Einstein to unify the two long-range forces of nature, gravity and electromagnetism. And here he is, first time on Coast to Coast, Dr. John Brandenburg. John, how are you?
Oh, I'm just great. And George, it's a great honor to be on your show.
I'm looking forward to this. We've been talking about your work for a few months now, John, and it's truly incredible. How did you, as a little John Brandenburg, did you like physics at that time?
The tales my parents told me of when I was young are incredible. My mother told me that I would not go to sleep unless they took me to a nearby electric power substation where I could hear the hum of the electricity. And at 2 years old, I was climbing into the basements of nearby houses and taking their electrical lights, you know, from like Christmas lights that they had stored, and bringing them back to the house. I was so fascinated with electricity. In fact, I told my mother when I went to kindergarten the first day, I said, I'm so glad I'm going to kindergarten. They're going to teach me about electricity and magnetism.
Isn't that amazing how even at that age, it develops into what you become later on in life?
It did. I was like, it's like I was programmed from birth for this.
I was the same way. I used to do a little broadcasting when I was a kid, John.
Oh.
I used to launch rockets. I've told this story at many speaking engagements and on the program before. You will love this because you'll understand it. I would build these little rockets, a company called Estes. They're still out there. They were based in Colorado. Yes. Solid propellant little rockets, and I'd launch these things up 1,200 feet. I would put little frogs in the capsules. They'd come down with parachutes. It was incredible. And what I decided to do, my buddy was Gary Frank. We went to school together. We did everything. And I said, Gary, let's do this. You know, I build these rockets. You put the little engines in them, and you launch them, and I'll broadcast the launch. So they launched. You would stick these little electrodes in these solid propellant engines, hook it up to a battery and push a button, and it would heat up, and then shoo, off the rocket would go. And right before he did that,
myself.
And I would give the countdown to the neighborhood. So I would broadcast the launch. Gary would launch it. Well, I end up going into broadcasting. Gary built the engines for the space shuttle, John.
Ah, God bless him.
Unbelievable. I mean, but again, at that young age, it develops who you become later on in life.
It very much did. And the inspiration for me doing this with my life has been my uncle worked on the Manhattan Project. His name was William Surrey. He's a very accomplished physicist. And he also was the founder of the Sierra Club in California.
Yeah.
But I remember rushing up to my father at 11 years old. My father's a World War II combat veteran, and he's living the good life in suburbia. He's painting a fence in his backyard. And I said, Dad, I want to be a physicist like Uncle Will, but I don't know what to work on. And he's just painting this fence very leisurely and wearing his old army boots from war. And he says, without even looking at me, he says, well, I got an idea. Why don't you try and complete Einstein's unified field theory? He says, if you're going to be a dog, it's good to have a good good bone to chew.
That's right.
He said.
And he was right.
And he was right. turned into a great problem, and I have literally worked on it since I was 11 years old.
Well, we're going to get into a lot of this. John, you're with me for about 3 hours tonight, which
Absolutely.
Is a very intense radio interview, but I have a feeling you are going to shine like a light bulb, my friend. So good view. Can you explain for us, though, because you are a plasma physicist, truly, when they talk about the Higgs boson particle or the God particle, I mean, to people who really don't understand physics, what does this mean? What is this?
I have a little bit of a problem with the Higgs boson. It's predicted by theory, but it's a little bit shaky, I think. And I asked a friend of mine who actually goes over and works on the Large Hadron Collider in Europe.
Yeah.
I said, okay, if the Higgs boson gives everything mass, what gives it mass? And he didn't know. And I got a deep sense of worry at that point that maybe they hadn't really quite tied up all the loose ends in this theory yet. Rutherford, the great physicist who discovered the nucleus of the atom, said, if you can't explain an idea to a barmaid, you don't really understand it.
Well, you know, it's almost like saying, who created the creator? It's that puzzling, isn't it?
Yeah, and I, you know, as far as I'm concerned, E equals MC squared. Energy equals mass. So somehow this Higgs is contributing energy, but, you know, the calling it the God particle, let me tell you something. A good experimental physicist, I've done a lot of plasma experiments, becomes very superstitious. You don't want God working against you in these experiments.
That's great. Hey, by the way, you have an old friend who wanted me to say hello to you tonight, and
Who's
it's
that?
Richard C. Hoagland.
Richard C. Hoagland.
He listens to the show religiously. He's an integral part of it.
I hope you're listening in. I hope you are having a good time. And he's a brilliant man.
He sure is.
And he did great work. He made the face in Cydonia more recognizable than George Washington on the dollar bill.
We will get into that because you were interested
Absolutely
in that.
Absolutely, we'll get into that. We have some interesting stories to tell about this.
Tell me about Albert Einstein. Not his life, but about his brain. How did a guy like this think the way he did without a computer?
He had an intense imagination, and he would do what he called Gedanken experiments. And I actually copied his method of analysis. And he also was an innate physicist. He had a very strong physical intuition for how things should work. And this also, by the way, made him kind of a rebel. He pushed his ideas when everyone kind of rejected them initially, and then he got them accepted. And then later in life, he returned to his rebellious state in that people were telling him this unified field theory of yours, it's nonsense. You shouldn't be doing it. You should be working on something with some money in it. You know, the government, and what's interesting is the government doesn't like you doing this work, Albert. They wish you'd work on something else.
Make bombs or something, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's where the money is.
That's right.
And instead, he pushed on, and he started his life in a patent office, kind of an outcast from physics, ended up being the king of physics, kind of the king of rock and roll, and ended up as an outcast in his later career. And in fact, he said later in life, he says, you know, I think the government doesn't like my work on the unified field theory. They seem to be opposing.
That's right. Ding dong, it woke up, huh?
That's right. But he worked on it till the day of his death. He was clutching his papers to his chest in his deathbed and telling his friend, I'm very close to solving the unified field.
What percent of his theories, John, do you think still hold up? 90%, 100%,
30%? 99%.
That much, that high.
Absolutely. He invented the theory of the laser. People don't realize that. He was like just a comet across the heavens. He spawned all sorts of good ideas. And the ideas he didn't come up with directly, he would encourage other people to publish. He would see their ideas and say, this is a good idea. And then he'd write a letter to the scientific journal saying, you should really publish this. And no journal could turn it down, a letter like that. So But the theory that the laser is based on, that was his theory.
I didn't know that.
Special relativity, general relativity, which is gives us black hole. You know, special relativity gives us the speed of light and increase of mass as things get near the speed of light. But general relativity gives us the black hole, wormholes, etc.
Yeah. Would he have liked Stephen Hawking?
I think they would have gotten along really well.
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell.
He didn't get along well with Niels Bohr, who was the founder of quantum mechanics. Bohr figured out the hydrogen atom. And he would get in big argument, big public debates with Bohr at conferences. He'd say, God doesn't play dice with the universe. And Bohr finally told him, he said, quit telling God what to do. And he did not like quantum mechanics. He felt that it interjected randomness into the universe. And he was kind of religious. He approached physics kind of religiously.
And
he felt that the universe was designed by an intelligent being, and that, in fact, he said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe it is comprehensible. And this led him to believe that it had been that there was what he called the Ancient One had designed the universe intelligently, and that he was basically finding out how he had done this. He didn't like to be pinned down on a religion, though. He would if people tried to get him in a corner, and he was Jewish at a time when there was like great persecution of the Jews in Europe. And if you asked him details of his religious beliefs, he would get this foxy look and say, "Well, my image of God is different than other people's."
Had he had today's computer, John, if he had some at his disposal, what kind of things would he have been able to do?
Oh, I think he would have done magnificent things. But a lot of the development of science during the last part of his life and, in the 60s and 70s revolved around the Cold War. And everything was very much keyed to defense.
Yeah.
And I think he had real problems with that. He was horrified that E equals MC squared from special relativity had ended up leading to the atomic bomb being dropped on Japan. And he had visited Japan. He loved the place. He wept when he left it. He wanted to go back and see them again. And the idea that the atomic bomb had been used on Japan just made him sick. And I think it also kind of inhibited him in his work. I think he was afraid that the unified field theory might lead to even more powerful weapons. I see no evidence of that in my own work, but people are very clever. Heisenberg, of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle,
he got
in the similar jam because he ended up being put in charge of Hitler's atomic bomb program. And if you study how they did that, it was obvious that Heisenberg did not want to succeed. He basically turned it into a giant search for the Higgs boson.
Yeah, though he could have developed this.
He could have had an enormous head start, but Oppenheimer, who had visited Europe and was a friend of Einstein and one of the most important men in physics you hardly ever hear about, the name named Paul Ehrenfest. He was a good friend of Einstein, good friend of Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, and a good friend of Oppenheimer.
Sounds like he got along with them all, huh?
He got along, which was hard to do.
Yeah.
And Oppenheimer had gone to visit Ehrenfest, and Ehrenfest was just horrified of the rise of Hitler in Germany. Remember, they're doing physics on the blackboard and everything like that, and the world is going crazy around them. And when Hitler came to power in Germany, Einstein decided that he would accept an invitation to come lecture in the United States. And he, being a very clever guy, had actually moved a lot of his money to the United States. So he just packed up his wife, his secretary, his wife's daughter, and they basically just moved to the United States in order to do this lecture tour. And he just never came back.
Never went back.
And Ehrenfest had a son who was mentally challenged, and he knew that Hitler wanted to kill everybody who was mentally challenged.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
And so Ehrenfest's response the day, just about a few months after Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, he got his son out of the institution for a day in the park, shot his son with a revolver, and blew his own brains out. I know, it was just complete despair.
Oh, my God.
But Ehrenfest knew that Hitler was going to conquer Europe, and Ehrenfest was Jewish. And he had communicated, apparently, all of this to Oppenheimer, his great terror of Hitler coming to power. And Oppenheimer was, of course, Jewish also. Oppenheimer came back to the United States watching everything in Europe carefully, and as soon as they published the first results of splitting the atom, Oppenheimer designed the atomic bomb on his blackboard the same day. He absolutely was primed, and of course, then Einstein by that time was in this country, and two physicists named Szilard and Edward Teller, whose school I attended, Lawrence Livermore Lab, they wrote a letter and had Einstein sign it. And they got it to Roosevelt. And Roosevelt kind of let the letter sit on his desk until Pearl Harbor happened a few days later.
And said, I better read this.
Yeah. Well, actually, Roosevelt was kind of impressed with the letter. You know, he read it himself, and he was pretty busy with the Depression and everything like that, and he was really worried about Hitler and the stuff in the Pacific. And so then, as soon as Pearl Harbor happened, they called in Szilard and Teller and Oppenheimer and said, do whatever you got to do. Mm-hmm. Blank check. Get the bomb before Hitler does.
And how close did Hitler come to getting that bomb?
Oh, they were pretty close. And with the V2, they could have won the war.
And they would have used
a big bomber that looked like a B-29 to carry the bomb.
They would have leveled every city in Britain, all over the place. They would not have stopped.
It would have been unspeakable. But we were good. And of course, we had the best scientists of Germany had all fled and came to the United States. They had this very sad reunion at Los Alamos of all of the really premier physicists like Bohr
Why didn't we get them all, John? Because some did go to the Soviet Union. Why didn't we just gobble them all up?
Oh, well, they wanted to get away as far away from Hitler as they could, and so they went wherever they could to get to be safe from him. And it wasn't just being Jewish. Anybody with above average intelligence who criticized Hitler could end up in a death camp.
That's right.
And, especially if your politics was left wing. So of course, by the time the war ended, We went into Germany, us and the British and us, and scooped up every physicist we could find. If you could spell the word physics,
you're in.
He would just grab you, that's how we got von Braun and everybody. But the Russians also came looking in Germany. They had taken over half of Germany, and they scooped up everybody they could find. And fortunately, being Russians, they said they captured all these German scientists, but they wouldn't let them have any books, you know.
That's great insight. Hey, John, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back and talk about the unified field and get into your work on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, become a Coast Insider. Join the club for less than 25 cents a day. Merely go to coasttocoastam.com and you can find out all about it. Coast Insider. And we are with physicist John Brandenburg here on Coast to Coast AM. John, how long have you worked on the unified field theory?
in earnest probably since 1975, and I basically had to learn a lot. I had to learn a lot about Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is the relativistic theory of gravity. And one thing that really helped me, well, when I got involved working with Vince DiPietro and Dick Hoagland on Mars, a great inspiration because, as I'll say, Mars is the gateway to the stars. But but also what happened was that I became very aware of the power of science to change the future of humanity. I was in finally in Washington, D.C., working on SDI, you know, the Reagan Star Wars Defense System. And it was a very exciting time, and I just, you got a feeling that everything was possible, and I began working very hard on it at that point, about 1986. So it was about 10 years after I got graduated from college, and I got my PhD in about 1981, so it was about 5 years after that. And I also became interested in string theory. I was developing models, and then the string theory came along, and basically they were talking about a lot of the same things. String theory is, of course, an attempt to use hidden dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A lot of physics. And
that's Michio Kaku's bailiwick, huh?
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes. And what people don't realize is the whole idea of hidden dimensions was actually pioneered by Einstein indirectly, because the person who proposed the hidden dimension was a guy named Theodor Kaluza. And he wrote a letter to Einstein saying, gee, like, I've discovered this way of mathematically unifying E&M and gravity. You know, the numbers of for the force don't work out, but he says the math works. And I do is add this new hidden dimension, a fifth dimension. And Einstein was a little bit grumpy about this, but he said, you know, this is really interesting, he says. So he sent it into a journal with a letter saying, you know, this should be published. And no one could turn down Einstein. So lo and behold, the thing got published. And another fellow been built on that. And so the theory is now called Kaluza-Klein. A Swedish physicist named Klein, kind of made the theory, worked out some of the mathematical problems, tied up some loose ends. So the hidden dimension theory was actually would never have been heard of except for Einstein. And, but at the same time, believe it or not, Einstein didn't like it.
At all.
I mean, he didn't like it because it talked a lot, it got involved in quantum mechanics. He didn't like quantum mechanics. He said, God doesn't play dice with the universe. And I actually end my book by saying, well, God may not play dice, but he does own the casino.
He does own the casino, no, and he always wins.
always wins. The dice, he's got this thing pretty well worked out. And so the string theory is actually based indirectly on Einstein's influence on physics. He was very open to strange new ideas, and him and Heisenberg and Bohr dueled kind of in physics for years. In fact, Heisenberg, the guy who ended up in charge of Germany's atomic bomb problem, he thought that physics was a big mystery, unlike Einstein, who liked to figure everything out. Heisenberg said, oh, no, it's a black box. The whole universe is a bunch of connected black boxes. And he had worked out quantum mechanics. He says, don't even try and imagine it. You know, Bohr had this electron orbiting the nucleus like a planet around the sun. And everybody liked that because it was easy to visualize. And but Heisenberg said, oh, no, you shouldn't even think about models like that. It's all a mystery. It's a black box. And he had worked out this kind of black box version of a black magic version of quantum mechanics. And what happened then was Einstein heard about this guy who'd worked out a field equation, you know, a regular equation. And this guy was named Schrodinger. and he sent his work to Einstein.
That's your Schrodinger cat's theory, right?
Schrodinger of the Schrodinger cat.
Yeah.
And Einstein probably laughing all the way to the post office, once again, sent this thing in to a journal with a letter saying this should be published immediately. And what it did is it threw a big cherry bomb into the courtyard of the Copenhagen Institute of Quantum Mechanics. Because Bohr and especially Heisenberg were just devastated when this guy published this wave equation, because suddenly stuff made sense again. It wasn't a black box; it was waves, you know.
Which they can understand, right?
Which people can understand, at least, you know, vaguely. There's still a lot. Nobody really understands quantum mechanics. That's what Feynman said. He says. There are about a dozen people on Earth who understand, you know, Einstein's theory of general relativity, you know, black holes and stuff, he says, but no one understands quantum mechanics. And Feynman himself had gotten the Nobel Prize for working on quantum mechanics, so I consider him a real authority.
Yeah.
But anyway, Einstein, if he couldn't overthrow quantum mechanics directly, he basically sent arms to rebels in the hills. And He thought Schrodinger's work was really great, and Bohr and Heisenberg were very upset, and Schrodinger was then in Germany, and saw the rise of Nazism, and believe it or not, the Schrodinger's cat trapped in the box,
whether it was alive or dead.
Whether it was alive or dead, and you couldn't tell until you opened the box. I want you to know how gruesome that actually was. The idea was that the cat is trapped in the box with a vial of poison gas, cyanide.
I wonder where that came from.
I wonder where that... Well, this was before the death camp.
Yeah.
What's interesting, it presaged... It was like he was talking about Auschwitz before it ever happened, and he was in Germany... And he said, if the radioactive atom decays, then the vial of cyanide is broken and the cat dies. And when, you know, people think of the cat in the box and they think it's alive or dead, but they don't realize the detail, gruesome detail he went into.
That's right. And the theory was it could be alive and dead at the same time?
Yes.
Yeah.
And... Of course, Einstein didn't like that idea.
He didn't like that theory. That was way out for him, too.
Well, in fact, it was. Einstein, believe it or not, was actually kind of a...
He's a pretty practical guy.
He was a practical guy.
Yeah.
And, in fact, even though he got the hidden dimension theory published, which later is the basis of string theory, he said... I don't like this hidden dimension business. If it's hidden, why can't you see it, you know? he wanted things all to be out on the table.
So he would not be one of those boosters for the multiverse theory today, would he?
No, he wasn't. He was, he thought...
Which is based on string theory.
On the table. The multiverse is based on string theory. Hidden dimensions based with themselves, hidden dimensions. You see some of the diagrams they show of the Kalabi-Yau universe. It's all twisted up like a pretzel. He probably would have rejected all of that completely. And he was a rebel. Even later in life, he returned to being a rebel. He was basically in his mountain outpost at Princeton Institute. Drawing a salary and working on his unified field theory, and people said, Al, why don't you work on the hydrogen bomb? You know, there's money in that. And, you know, nuclear physics and particle physics, the quarks and stuff. And he said he wasn't interested in that stuff, and Oppenheimer kind of walked around, who was running the institute at that point, said, well, Einstein's really kind of cuckoo. He's crazy. He's a crazy old man. What's this? You know,
a genius
like Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars.
Yeah,
he's a crazy. He's a crazy old man, old Obi-Wan. And there's a feeling, and I read recently that one of Einstein's last statements was that he thought that he sort of detected that the government itself was trying to isolate him. And
that may be true.
It may be true. And I kind of confronted that in this theory that I've worked out, because it leads to the flying saucer.
It sure does.
To harness this.
When I saw that you tied this into electromagnetism, I looked at this and said, not only does this deal with propulsion for UFOs, but I think it also, you could be also talking about a time machine, John.
Yes. Apparently, in the theory that I have developed, well, you know how airplanes fly. They use the Bernoulli equation. The wing, the air flows over the top of the wing.
Mm-hmm. For the lift?
And it makes lower pressure on the top of the wing, so the higher pressure below the wing pushes the wings up. A similar effect occurs in this theory. It falls right out. It is not hard to get it. And I call it the vacuum Bernoulli equation. And it says that you can actually change local gravity with strong electromagnetic fields. Now, obviously, I don't have a flying car. It's got four wheels. There are a few engineering details that have to be worked out, and the field strengths may be so powerful that it may not be practical for a long time, except with portable nuclear power.
Let me ask you this, John, too. I mean, you've touched on something, and I've got to ask you for two reasons. One, you might know. Two, you at least could guess. But a lot of people, from police officers to citizens, a lot of people have reported for years now seeing a huge triangular-shaped object which makes no sound, which just seems to take off in at a whim. I don't know how you could move something that big.
Well, and a lot of those first reports were down near Site 51.
Near 51? They're near Air Force bases? To me, it sounds like we've got one or two of these things, and we've tested them. Or they could be extraterrestrial. We won't get into that quite as fast right now. But
sure.
Is it possible, or do you know, if government is working on an electromagnetic propulsion system?
I believe they are. I believe Nick Cook actually, that's the book Hunt for Zero Point.
Yes.
I think this has been a long-standing interest of the government, and it could account for the fact that the government did not like Einstein's work. They wanted him to work on something else because they didn't trust Einstein. Hoover was convinced that Einstein was a communist.
No. Really?
Yes, because he had long hair and sailed on his boat, and he was from Europe and had strange political views, and
Hoover didn't?
So, what's that?
Hoover didn't? He had.
Hoover didn't. Yeah. Well, that's a whole can of worms there. So Hoover was convinced. In fact, when he had his agents going through all of Einstein's papers and stuff surreptitiously, and finally they came up empty. They had no evidence that he was a communist at all. In fact, he hated Stalin as bad as Hitler, and so then they started investigating his secretary.
Unbelievable.
It was like, well, find something on somebody.
Yeah, that's office. Right. If not, planet,
That's right. If not, planet. And so, but what happened is he may have been doing, the E&M gravity work may have gone black by that point. It was a classified project, like the hydrogen bomb was, and this was, the 50s and early 60s. And, of course, we know that the Germans were apparently involved in this work in World War II. And I look at the reports of the Bell experiments, and it looks to me like they had found an effect, but that in the end it took so much electric power that they just couldn't, it could never lead to, they could never make a practical flying machine with it. They basically had a remarkable gravity modification effect using vortex electromagnetic fields. They also put mercury in there, and there's two reports. One is that the scientists would, about 60 scientists got sick and died, which wouldn't be...
Mercury poisoning, right?
Yeah, mercury poisoning, which is, you know, is a great, was a great killer of scientists
yeah.
in those days. But also then the other story is that Kammler, the SS general in charge of this, rather than let these people run away and join the Allies, he basically had them all rounded up and shot.
Oh, my God.
And kept all the reports for himself and traded them for plane tickets to Argentina.
How?
Now, you can imagine Uncle Sammy having a difficult time explaining maybe how he got some of his work.
That's right.
On this. You know, well, I traded this for some plane tickets to Argentina from some people I knew. And, of course, when that happened, apparently the Russian army was approaching from the east. And the work was being done in eastern Germany, you know, where they have they found the little Stonehenge-looking thing.
Boy, they were so far ahead, though, weren't they?
Yeah, they were.
Oh, my God.
But as it turns out, what you do in physics, if you can't turn it into engineering, like the only way to generate that much, a lot of electrical power in those days was to have an airplane motor, like an air-cooled airplane motor running a generator. And, of course, by that time, probably some aerodynamic engineer said, well, why don't we forget all about all of these copper coils and stuff for the gravity and just put a propeller on the yeah. engine. It'll fly better.
And there's our jet.
And there's our jet. You know, we have stuff that flies already really well, and this thing is really heavy and can't lift itself and its power supply at the same time. We got to feed it power. It's got to, unless we have a very long extension cord, this is not going to lead to any weapon that's going to change the war. You know, of course, their jet fighter almost changed the war. Most people don't realize, by the way, that the jet fighter was set back a year because the American bombers bombed the factory and burned up all the blueprints for it.
Huh. All right, I didn't know that.
About it, yeah, nobody, very few, it's a very, the same place where time when they bombed all of the ball bearing plants, they actually hit this Messerschmitt factory and it burned up all the blueprints. And you think, well, they should have just used their computer drives to make more blueprints. Well, that's not the way it worked in those days.
No, that's right.
And so by a kind of a miracle stroke of luck, that jet fighter was delayed for a year by a big bombing raid.
John, let me ask you this, though.
Probably why I'm alive, because my father was on a bomber in World War II.
That could be. How fast could an object go that had this electromagnetic propulsion system in space?
The work that has been done by a physicist in Albuquer, I believe is the right pronunciation, the Spanish, says that you can make a bubble of space-time. And effectively, its speed can be infinite.
Faster than the speed
go
of light?
As fast as you want. Yes, you can go as fast. Remember, people who keep talking about the speed of light are applying the work of Einstein on the special theory of relativity.
Right.
And you know what the specialist rank of a specialist is in the Army? It's, you know, it's like a sergeant or something. And but specialist four. Relativity is overruled by general relativity, which gives you the black hole, where special relativity is done in flat space-time. But in general relativity, space becomes itself a variable along with time. It warps, it bends, it can be twisted into a pretzel. And when you have that freedom, the speed of light is not as important anymore. In fact, models for the how the universe began with the Big Bang, it expands faster than light in the early phases. So the universe, in fact, I tell people, I said, if they're faster than light, physics is possible. The universe is probably already using it. And in fact, one of the simplest mathematical ways to get dark energy, which is causing the universe to expand more and more rapidly, is what are called tachyons, which are faster than light particles.
Let's get into your gem theory, John, when we come right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.